So this for, I'm really happy actually, it's a full moon. I thought we're going to do something a little bit unusual. We're going to have this kind of class, which is a bit of informal. We're not, but we're going to do the precept ceremony afterwards. Because traditionally we do it on the full moon. And the precept ceremony is all about vows. And guess what the topic is tonight? I'm talking about this. I think for about three, maybe four classes, I wanted to talk about this practice in the Buddhist tradition of vows and how we may use it. Tonight, I'll talk about that in a moment. In these classes, we'll look at the Buddhist tradition, the kind of origin of vows within the Buddhist tradition. We'll look at how vows have supported various practitioners in more modern times, like some of the great contemporary Zen teachers a little bit. With a kind of focus of considering what is the purpose of vows and also how might vows support our practice that we do here. And I'll probably spend maybe one class really looking at what we call the bodhisattva vows. Those four vows of, you know, beings are numberless, I vow to save them, delusions are endless, I vow to end them, etc. In fact, we'll be chanting that a little bit tonight. And particularly, I want to consider the kind of endless and seemingly impossible nature of the vows that we often take in this practice, or that certain practitioners take within this practice. What that means and how we might use that, or if it's appropriate. But throughout this little series of classes, I'd like us to really keep this thoughts about vows very personal, asking ourselves what a vow may mean to us and the kind of vows maybe we've already made. I think everyone here has probably made vows, whether they're clearly articulated or not, but throughout your life. So I'd like us to think about that. I'd like us to think about what vows, perhaps unacknowledged, that we have made. Kind of dig them out a little bit and realize that this is why we behave or why we have certain values that we do, because they're supported by a kind of unspoken or perhaps unrecognized vow that we've made at some point. So tonight, kind of talk a little bit in general about vows, and then starting next week we'll dig in a little bit more to the Buddhist perspective of vows, and then particularly the Zen perspective, how vows are used in this particular tradition. So, New Year's is the time to come clean. And in Japan, the custom is to clean the home, the place of business, the school, the zendo, classrooms from top to bottom. Everything is cleaned, making everywhere clean and fresh to welcome the new year. And I remember when I lived in Japan with my old Aikido teacher in a place called Kanazawa, kind of a small city. And I was quite young then. I was only 19 years old. But I would work with Oksan, his wife, at New Year's, just before New Year's, scrubbing the stone entranceway and washing the windows, dusting. And for 3 or 4 days, just before the New Year, every morning, Oksan would wrap her hair in a kind of a long strip of cloth, put on this full apron, look kind of like an old-fashioned apron, and end up cleaning for most of the day. And the only time she wasn't kind of bustling about dusting or sweeping or mopping or washing was when she repaired and replaced the kind of delicate rice paper screens that Japanese houses have. Those kind of sliding screens and windows and doors. fingers get poked through those little, those rice paper squares. And she would repair or replace the delicate rice paper all throughout the house. She would sit on her knees for hours doing this work, because there's a lot of windows and sliding doors in most houses. And carefully removing all that torn paper and carefully pasting on, gluing on the fresh. Everything that could be repaired was. And all clutter was sent off to recycling or put out for garbage. But it didn't end there. On New Year's Day, we would all troop off to the large public baths, because many old Japanese houses, including my teachers, didn't have a bath, like a bathtub or shower. Instead, there were public baths. Delightful places, by the way. Large steaming pools of hot water that you would, like huge hot tubs, right? And often three or four different kinds of hot tubs within the facility. So you would soak in one that was really hot, or one that was mildly hot, or one that had electrical shocks going through it. It was kind of weird, that one. Or one that was filled, had, it was like a murky water, but they had put various kinds of herbs and things in it so that it'd be quite refreshing. So we would scrub ourselves off, soak for an hour or two, and then put on fresh, clean clothes. So everything's clean, everything's new, fresh. But it didn't stop there either. Because traditionally, this was the time to pay off all your debts and to mend any broken relationships so the new year could be welcomed without any burden at all. Isn't that a great custom? And of course, here in the West, New Year's is also a time to kind of get clean in a way. It's a time many of us make resolutions to kind of clean up our act. Many resolve, of course, to lose weight, exercise regularly, watch less TV, take a class, learn a musical instrument, or even come to the Zendo regularly. At some time or other, most of us have made, I think, some kind of New Year's resolution. And I've noticed in the newspapers several articles about ways or aids to help keep resolutions, because I suspect, as was the case for me, probably the case for you, that most resolutions kind of fall by the wayside before very long. Because the push and pull of life distracts, and the power of old habits can be pretty strong. So after failing in our resolutions often enough, we may actually give up making resolutions in order to avoid that disappointment or shame that inevitably comes when the goal is not achieved. We can become shy about stating out loud to others our intentions or resolutions or promises, and even get to the point of refusing to act on any resolution to change our life that kind of pops up within us, like, oh yeah, I should really lose 3 or 4 pounds. Perhaps thinking, after all, what's the point? I probably won't get there anyway, or it's too hard. I think our modern culture has largely lost the custom of making strong promises or giving voice to them, giving voice to kind of our deep aspirations. Certainly, we've lost that custom of doing that in the presence of others. I was thinking about this, you know, other than something like wedding vows, swearing an oath in the court, maybe citizenship ceremonies, those kind of things. The only other time I could think of where people actually kind of make a public vow is in something like an AA meeting. or some kind of organization like that. And I think that's really unfortunate, as vows can really give our lives a clear, strong direction, and they can give us patience in the face of obstacles that arise. So I've been using this word vow, and I realize there's a number of words that kind of overlap, and like words like promise or intention. So let me try to clarify what exactly I'm talking about, so that we can have some kind of shared understanding about what I mean by vow as a practice. And I hope that this shared understanding will also help us when we consider how vows are used and practiced within the Buddhist tradition. So I'm going to kind of narrow it down. Whether you agree or not with this kind of explanation of vow, I don't think that's not really important. I think what's important is just to get a sense of a word that we can share and kind of be talking about the same thing. So, a vow is an expression of what matters most to us. One Zen teacher uses the expression, the heart's deepest aspiration. The heart's deepest aspiration. And I think he's pretty close. I would say a vow is the expression of the heart's deepest aspiration. At times in our life, we're struck with a profound yearning to express our life deeply and fully in a certain way. This yearning, I think, can slowly build, or it can suddenly appear, but it always comes from the heart, from our experience, rather than some kind of intellectual understanding. Let me give you an example, kind of mundane example. My mother, when she was a little girl, struggled with her own mother's really sharp criticism and tight-fistedness. And as a little girl, she decided she would never inflict her children in that way. It was one of her childhood vows. And she didn't really clearly articulate it when she was a little girl, though it became stronger and she gave language to it as she grew up a little bit more. But it was one vow that she made that was really a force throughout her whole life. She would never be tight-fisted with her children. And she wasn't. In fact, she wasn't tight-fisted with anyone. And she was never sharply critical. In fact, she could have been a little more critical, you know, kind of knock us into line a little bit more. But that was her vow. And children make vows. And maybe they're not well articulated, but these vows that children make shape how they grow up. In his book, Taking Our Places, Dzogchen Norman Fisher, who's kind of the guiding teacher of Mountain Rain, in his book, Taking Our Places, he writes of one of his own childhood vows that arose for him, as he sat in a synagogue classroom, I think it was kind of like Sunday school, learning the kind of sad and inspiring stories of the Jewish martyrs. And this is a quote from his book. He says, "I felt myself sitting in my seat at that moment as though it were an eternal moment. And I thought, I will be like that too. I will never give up what I am, never give up what I know to be so because someone tries to force me to. I felt that because of what people before me had endured in being true to their deepest identities and commitments, I too would endure and remain steadfast in their honor and in their name. As a Jewish child listening to a Jewish tale, I felt a vow come upon me to hold fast to being a Jew no matter what. A vow I have always kept in my heart, despite the fact I have practiced Buddhism for so long. There are several things about this story that I found quite moving, and I also think illustrate a little bit what I'm trying to say about vows. I think it's not so much we create vows, but they arise within us. We are inspired or moved in some way. And they remain in us. Sometimes we forget them, but I think they remain inside. And if we're aware, we give them life. So there are many ways that vows can arise within us. And this one, Norman's, kind of strikes me as what I think of as an inherited vow. One that comes from his family's religious tradition, from the stories shared amongst his family and the religious community. And perhaps you have inherited a vow, you know, from your parents or grandparents or our community. It really is not unusual for children and young people, youth, to make vows, these kind of sweeping promises that will take many years, if not a lifetime, to fulfill or to complete. And these vows can be also of what is not wanted. A vow not to be or act in a certain way. One of my childhood vows was not to cause fear in others, because I was so fearful of my father's sudden anger. This childhood vow, like the childhood vow of my mother, I guess we could call a kind of reactive vow, a vow that's made in the face of a difficult or challenging situation. Jan Chosen Bays, a Zen teacher and a physician, who worked with abused children, has written about children that she worked with who have made vows, sometimes not very well articulated, but nonetheless very strong and full of energy. Vows, for example, to never drink alcohol, vows to never hit their own children. So another kind of vow that maybe most of us have been touched on or touched by growing up, that, and also I think that can easily arise, particularly in our youth, are vows that are inspired by others, by the lives of others. Someone either directly or indirectly has inspired us, and we aspire to be like them. Perhaps we wished to emulate a superhero, always be brave and strong. Or perhaps we're inspired by someone we've read about. When I was 20, as I mentioned earlier, I lived in Japan with my Japanese Aikido teacher. And he was relatively poor, living off donations from his students, and he had no savings. But he fed me, he took me to restaurants and coffee shops when he had any money, he made sure I had medical attention, and he housed me for over a year. Yet he refused to take any money from me. At that time, I didn't consciously make a vow. But years later, I discovered a vow in me, a vow of open-handedness and sharing. He was very inspiring. So, I think vows, as I'd like us to use them, are expressions of what matters most. But vows are also limitless in their scope, and they also give us energy and direction for our life. Unlike a simple promise or a resolution to meet a certain goal, I think vows can be held and practiced, but never really completed. And it's this quality that gives vows an energy to propel us forward and kind of shape our actions. Let me give you an example. The wedding vow in the Anglican Book of Common Prayer kind of goes like, to have and hold from this day forward, for better or worse, for richer or poorer, in sickness and in death, to love and cherish until death do its part. The vow is only complete at death. It only ends there. So in this way, it's kind of different from a goal, right? You can't, well, of course, modern vows are a little different, right? I mean, they kind of have like time limits, some of them, like 5 years, I'll do my best. After that, we'll renegotiate. So another example might be, you know, a goal might be to become a doctor, right? You work really hard to become a doctor. But that's a goal. I think a vow would be more like becoming a doctor is the means. But the vow would be to alleviate the suffering of others or to heal the wounds of others. That's a vow. And of course, a vow that has no end. And we'll talk more about this kind of limitlessness, this quality of limitlessness that vows have when we talk about the Bodhisattva vows in the next class or two. I think that vows basically are acts of imagination. They're acts of imagination and courage. Vows can arise out of a longed for and imagined world, right? A world without prejudice. We imagine perhaps a world without hunger, cruelty, drug abuse, homelessness. Some problem or suffering moves us, and we consider perhaps, or imagine a time or place or world without that kind of suffering. A vow is what shifts us from simply musing about life to becoming a driving force of life, pushing us forward. A vow is to imagine a different course, a different way of being in this world. And it is an act of courage because the vow will set us on a course of life beyond what we may desire or even control. It will at times run counter to our apparent kind of self-interest and force us to make difficult decisions. Right? For better or worse, for richer or poorer. Well, what if it's for worse? And what if it's for poorer? And what if it's for sickness? Can we stay the course when our spouse or partner is diagnosed with something like Alzheimer's? Can we share and practice generosity at a time when we have very little ourselves? I think vows create opportunities for self-transcendence. And self-transcendence involves hardship. And I mean by that kind of small self-transcendence. To me, this means that though I will never be free from life's challenges and hardships, like sickness, old age, death being some examples, vows will allow me to overcome the dismay and despair over the adversities of life. Hadn't really thought about this, but I just realized now there are also what I would think unwholesome vows. Those vows that we make, you know, out of anger or bitterness or hurt or greed. The vow to, you know, kind of get back at somebody, to outdo somebody, to become filthy rich, no matter what. I think these vows can also become a driving force, sadly. But perhaps they're not really vows. Perhaps they're curses. We curse ourselves by saying, you know, I'm going to get rich no matter what. And we curse others. These kind of vows really don't lead to openness or intimacy. They lead to constriction and more suffering, of course, in the end. They close down our open-heartedness. But let me just kind of close by bringing it to a Buddhist perspective. And then for the next couple of weeks, we'll be looking at that really from a Buddhist perspective. There is a Japanese expression, Gosho no Bonpu, Gosho no Bosatsu. And it's a definition of a bodhisattva. And Shohaku Okumura, I'll show you his book in a moment here, he translates it like this. Ordinary people are those who live being pulled by their karma. Bodhisattvas are those who live led by their vows. Let me read that one more time. Ordinary people are those who live being pulled by their karma. Bodhisattvas are those who live led by their vows. Now, karma is a topic for another class. But here, I think we can consider karma as our own delusions, pettiness, craving, frustration, rage, confusion, envy, our own woundedness. I could go on, but I think you get the point, right? We are pulled by those things. And we need to ask ourselves, which life do I want to live? A life pulled by karma or a life led by vow? And some other questions would be, like, well, how do I live a life by vow? What does that mean? And what is the Buddhist understanding of vow, which we'll explore a little bit more? These are some questions I'd like to explore in the coming weeks. But I'd like to give you a little homework assignment to take with you, since we don't really have time to kind of do it here together. And I'd like you to really spend a little bit of time thinking about what vows have arisen and shaped your life. I've given you some examples of, you know, childhood things, but there may be others as well have arisen and shaped your life. And how do you feel about them? Have they been positive? Have you had to push them aside? Just how do you feel about them? So two questions, and then one more. What vows would you like to make? What vows would you like to make? So next week, we'll look at a Buddhist understanding of vows and consider some ways that those might help us in our practice and also in our interactions with other people in the world. And if they will be helpful, I shouldn't say they will be, maybe they won't be. That'll be for you to decide. But tonight, as I said at the beginning, though, because of this lovely full moon out there, and it's so rare that we really get to do this on a Wednesday night, I thought we would do the Bodhisattva vows together, the full moon ceremony. Has everyone here participated in that before? No? No? Not everyone? Okay. It comes from the started with the time of the Buddha and continued all the way up to the present day. Every full and new moon, the Buddhist community, the monks and nuns would gather, and they would recite their vows that they had made, and kind of acknowledge, you know, slipped up here, slipped up there, but kind of renew their intention for their practice. Kind of refresh their vows twice a month. And they had like a huge number. Like when you look at today, I think, I forget exactly, but the monks have something like 250 that they recite, and the nuns have like close to 300 that they recite. But ours are very brief. But still, I think, quite beautiful. So, maybe that's enough said. We'll just push our cushions back and we'll pass out the chant books. And Kevin will ring the bells for us.